Leading our worship service today will be Gary Bennett. Gary has been, in his words, a card-carrying UU since 1970, filling a variety of roles at churches in Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and since 2005 here at First UU Austin.
We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. What some persons, great and not so great, have to say on the subject of freedom. All but the last two of these are from Dr. Lawrence Peters' quotations. From Will Rogers, "Liberty doesn't work as well in practice as it does in speeches." From Mark Twain, "It is by the goodness of God that in our country we have three unspeakably precious things, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and the prudence never to practice either of them." From Theodore Roosevelt, "Order without liberty and liberty without order are equally destructive." Abraham Lincoln, "The shepherd drives the wolf from the sheep's throat, for which the sheep thanks the shepherd as his liberator, while the wolf denounces him for the same act as the destroyer of liberty." From Albert Camus, "Freedom is nothing else but a chance to be better." Ernest Benn, "Liberty is being free from the things we don't like in order to be the slaves of the things we do like." B.F. Skinner, "By a careful cultural design, we control not the final behavior, but the inclination to behave, the motives, the desires, the wishes. We increase the feeling of freedom." Eric Hoffer, "When people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other." Adlai Stevenson, "A free society is one in which it is safe to be unpopular." Abe Fortas, "The story of man is the history, first of the acceptance and impositions of restraints necessary to permit communal life, and second, of the emancipation of the individual within the system of necessary restraints." Bernard Malamud, on a different note, "The purpose of freedom is to create it for others." Virginia Woolf, "To enjoy freedom, we have to control ourselves." Edmund B. Chaffee, "The majority of us are for free speech only when it deals with those subjects concerning which we have no intense convictions." Howard Ickes, "Freedom to live one's life with the window of the soul open to new thoughts, new ideas, new aspirations." Gertrude Himmelfarb, "Liberty too can corrupt, and absolute liberty can corrupt absolutely." C. Wright Mills, "Nobody talks more of free enterprise and competition and the best man winning than the man who inherited his father's store or farm." Norman Thomas, after I asked him what he meant, he replied that freedom consisted of the unimpeded right to get rich, to use his ability, no matter what the cost to others, to win advancement. Daniel Webster, "Liberty exists in proportion to wholesome restraint." And the last two, from Chris Christopherson, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." And from yours truly, America is 100 million people going to the same place at the same time to do the same thing, but traveling in 100 million different cars. Tell people that I really wanted to call this sermon Freedom For and Against, but I didn't quite dare. If there's anything that humanity agrees upon, it is that freedom is a good thing, even if we profoundly disagree as to what freedom is. So I thought today we might try to explore exactly what freedom is all about and why it has such a hold on us. I want us to think about the tea parties on April 15th, not the politics, which bothered me a great deal, but what I would have to say there shouldn't come from the pulpit. But there were some serious moral issues that drew people to protest. There's the legacy of debt we're still piling up for the future. That old bumper sticker, we're spending our children's inheritance, isn't nearly so funny anymore. And then there's the idea that taxes are an evil thing because they take away our freedom. No taxation without representation, the patriots of 1776 said. And for some, the British tax on imported tea was such a dangerous matter, it justified dumping perhaps millions of dollars worth of tea into the harbor. And a monstrous act of vandalism. Liberty was the word they used, which is a little bit more narrowly political than freedom. At the dawn of history, we meet the Egyptian pharaohs and the Sumerian priest kings, gods or agents of gods who could not be crossed. There was only enough liberty for one. Actually, wealthy nobles were there to fight for power with them from the beginning. And gradually they established rules and boundaries. The Code of Hammurabi is the oldest set of written rules we know about, the oldest truce between king and nobles, if you will. And from it we get that rudimentary concept of justice, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. As far as liberty goes, though, there still wasn't much left over for anybody else. A similar struggle took place in England thousands of years later, leading to the Great Charter between King John and his barons. And we still consider that moment in 1215 the birthplace of our written law. One of the big bullet points of the Charter was the idea that new taxes could only be imposed by the king acting in Parliament. And that one took a while to percolate, but some 400 years later, that provision was the wedge that led to the English Civil War and ultimately the transfer of power to Parliament. So it's no wonder that the idea of taxes and that they could only be exacted with the consent of the governed still had a magic ring to it 100 years later. But we do have representative government, and there's nothing in the phrase that says your party has to win for taxes to be legitimate. But some of the people at the protest had been doing the same thing for some time. They were the libertarians, and they had been doing the tea parties for a number of years, and they cited a different tradition, and in this tradition, even taxes with representation are pretty sketchy. Englishmen, including those of us on this side of the pond, in the 18th century were actually pretty uncomfortable with the English Civil War as a model. It was pretty bloody. It was filled with religious disputes, what we would call culture wars. It was pretty dangerous to the propertied classes. A king got beheaded. And there was even the stirrings of what we would call democratic socialism. So good Enlightenment thinkers preferred to talk instead about the glorious or bloodless revolution of 1688. King James II was the sort of ruler who, by combining dangerous ambitions, ruthless means, and incredible stupidity, manages to give even despotism a bad name. And in short, he managed to unite the whole country against him in just 3 years, went into exile, and left everybody with a feeling that, well, this was sort of the English way of doing things. The revolution was popular, and its chief apologist, John Locke, became even more so. Inspired by the example of the very popular at the time Sir Isaac Newton, he proposed to show that the right of revolution arose from human nature itself. Man in a state of nature is isolated from all other human beings, surrounded by the infinite bounty of the world. But those riches are absolutely worthless, except insofar as he invests his own life force and liberty and gets his hand dirty and shapes them, all these things, into property which is indisputably his. Everybody else is around doing pretty much the same thing, and so they get into trading, and trading requires contracts, and ultimately somebody has to interpret and enforce the contracts. That's where the government comes in. Just sort of a bunch of hired hands, and as easily dismissed as you could fire that unsatisfactory lawn mowing service. There's no divine right of kings here, no naturally superior noble class, no sacrosanct tradition, nor was it anything like Hobbes and his idea that nature itself was so depraved and evil that only a crushingly oppressive force could keep people from destroying each other. Given the competition, Locke's ideas gained a great deal of favor from the progressive secular left thinkers of the Enlightenment. But the argument took on a force of its own, and some of the conclusions were troubling. While Locke agrees that voting is a very good way to put governors in place, it doesn't give them any special moral authority for robbing people of life, liberty, or property. Only an impartial judicial decision can justify taking away anybody's property. So, taxes, even from a legitimate government, really amounted to an unjustifiable seizure of property. Not a very popular idea for governments, not even those that come in from revolutions. So the Declaration of Independence drops the word property and talks about the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right. The preamble to the Constitution wants to promote providing for the common defense the way Locke would, but it also wants to promote the general welfare, which is very un-Lockean. Even Locke himself, a practical man, seems not to have taken the idea seriously. But over the years, it's gained a great deal of force. And modern libertarians are inspired by this goal of absolute individual freedom, of the government itself gradually withering away. Or as one person put it, getting small enough to drown in the bathtub. But as inspiring as Locke's words have been to generations of Americans, there are problems. His argument is flawed at the most basic level. His man in the state of nature has no navel. He has somehow come to be a full-blown, civilized Englishman without being born, nourished, or educated by the society of people around him. Otherwise, there would be no basis for claiming this absolute moral autonomy. He, like the rest of us, would begin his life in a web of obligations to other people. And you certainly can't. You might be able to justify property as an absolute right if it's your own labor, but how do you account for inherited wealth? And if you take this man in the state of nature out of the woods and put him into a modern American city, invested with the accumulated capital of technology and industry from earlier generations, then his property loses all relationship to the Lockean idea of property. At the same time, of course, as we get more and more crowded, the notion that resources are infinite becomes more and more absurd. Perhaps people do have the right to vastly unequal amounts of wealth, but you certainly have to find a different way of grounding that right. Survival of the fittest, maybe. We also see that insisting on the absolute right to wealth will undermine other basic values and, in the end, undercut freedom itself. If you're at the bottom of the economic ladder, you cannot negotiate fairly and evenly with giant, immortal corporations. Nor do these large, anonymous cities provide any good way, as traditional societies did, for providing for the sick, handicapped, or elderly. And no matter what your skills, you may find yourself in economic trouble if you exercise your freedom of speech, as many folks did during the McCarthy era with its blacklists. Or your freedom of religion may not be as absolute as you might think, as many Muslims have found out in the last 7 years. So there has come to be a completely different strand of liberal tradition, which is summarized in by Franklin Roosevelt in his Four Freedoms speech. It includes freedom of speech and religion, of course, but also freedom from want and freedom from fear. So freedom becomes not just a relationship between the individual and the state. It also involves relationships of individuals with one another and of entire peoples with one another. In the West, we have tended to forget this in the last few centuries, the so-called age of individualism. In ancient medieval times, it was different. For example, the Greeks prized freedom above all other things, but they measured it as the independence of their city-states, regardless of how they were governed. And they considered inhabitants of empires to be slaves, even if they were as benevolent as the Persians. And let's take another look at America in 1776. Did what the British do really justify bloody red revolution? I listened to their horrors. Taxes on stamps and tea. Really? They restricted settlement by the colonists west of the Appalachians to protect the Indians. Oh, that one's nasty. And, of course, they passed some punitive laws in after the Boston Tea Party. But it doesn't add up. And then there's the question. Suppose that the English government had been a bit cleverer and offered Americans representation in Parliament. Would that have quieted them down? With maybe a third of all the representatives in that body? Probably not. The real problem that our forefathers had was that they wanted to govern themselves. They had come to think of us as being a different nation from England. But nobody in the 18th century said that empires were wrong or that nations had the right to be independent, and so we had to borrow the vocabulary from the very different struggles of 17th century England. And sometimes it seems even today we don't get it. After World War II, Americans came to believe that there was no more urgent moral cause in the world than the struggle for democracy, capitalism, and freedom against communism. We were drawn into struggles in places like Iran, Guatemala, Chile, Cuba, and Vietnam, assuming that the peoples there would share our values. We didn't see that for many of them, distaste for American armies or puppet regimes would be a much stronger emotion than anti-communism. They were traditional cultures that thought in terms of freedom for the whole people rather than of freedom as being a matter of individual opportunity. For them, they had their own magic word, and the magic word was anti-colonialism. I would leave it as an exercise for the students, whether we might have been repeating some of the same mistakes in the Middle East today. And there's another problem with our idea of freedom. If everyone does everything he or she can, not just in terms of legal, but what we can actually get by with, can our nation survive? Maybe I could get along taking shortcuts in my job, cheating on taxes, stepping out on my wife, and in the wonderful words of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, stealing the change from blind men's cups. Some people do, and we probably even know a few. When Amy and I lived in Philadelphia, the story we heard was that any time a city bus was involved in any kind of accident, more people filed whiplash lawsuits than could ever fit on a bus. But in real life, even in Philadelphia, only a small fraction of people push the envelope this way. But no, if everyone acted that way, we could not remain free. There aren't enough enforcers, and we don't want there to be enough enforcers to have eyes everywhere at once. We expect that most people have a higher standard than what they can get by with. So, what is the point of individual freedom if it only works when most people are careful not to use it? Well, we could say that speaking freely is always good, except maybe when what we're saying is shouting fire in a crowded theater. Other nations wouldn't even go that far. Democracies, very much like us, in Britain, France, and Germany, clamp down much harder than we do on what they consider hate speech or libel. And you could probably make the same arguments for freedom of religion, of assembly, and of the press, and certainly for all the freedoms from government intrusion. But in practice, when you get down to it, we allow a great deal of freedom of action as well, including many actions which are not good for this, for us or for society as a whole. And it could be, and it has been argued, that the real purpose of freedom is that it's the condition for moral behavior. I get no brownie points for not cheating on the test if the teacher is watching like a hawk the whole time I take it. It was certainly important to the Puritans, who in the 1600s were fighting on two fronts, arguing politically for the rights of Englishmen and arguing religiously for the general Protestant argument of the priesthood of all believers. Just as a priest cannot assume responsibility for my ultimate salvation or damnation, so the state shouldn't block me from going to hell in my own fashion. Only by being free to sin can I be virtuous in not sinning. And certainly there's a lot of philosophers and theologians and moralists through the centuries that have gone along with that. They have seen the liberation in self-denial. Doing what comes naturally is to act in a subhuman or bestial fashion. The opposite of freedom is slavery to one's appetites. Some conservatives would argue similarly that any time the government forces us to do good things, like pay taxes to pay for welfare or other good projects, it robs us of the opportunity to act morally by contributing of our own free will. Okay, so here we are. For some, freedom is a matter of absence of any external restraint, so that even taxation for good causes is a kind of slavery. And perhaps because only in the absence of outside coercion can we act morally. And a very, very old tradition says that freedom is the right of your group, your tribe, your nation, not to be controlled by others, and that the amount of coercion you personally feel is much less important. To the people at the top of the totem pole, freedom is about not being restrained from exercising power. To the people at the bottom, it is how effectively their bosses can be reined in. And yet, with all these conflicting ideas of what they are talking about, most people assume that they can bandy the term around and have everyone understand. And that, you see, is the real question. What is freedom? Perhaps all of these are just pieces of the same intuitive feeling that we have because it is hardwired in. The true state of nature is not what Locke postulates. It's the lives we lived and which shaped us over hundreds of thousands or even millions of years, wandering in small hunter-gatherer bands. The proto-humans, the early humans, had no strong sense of individuality, nor of any conflict between their needs and the needs of the group. None of these groups afforded any special resources for police or army to force actions that were good for the survival of everybody. And yet the tribes survived. If a tribe were to disintegrate through the selfishness of its members, then the needs of the dependent, unskilled young to grow into a new generation would not be met, and the whole group would disappear from the gene pool. So there was a very, very strong natural selection of human beings from the beginning against that kind of selfishness. Emotions, religious feelings, and moral beliefs reinforced tribal identification, and the idea of freedom of both the tribe and the individual parts working freely together gradually became hardwired in. In evolutionary terms, the last 10,000 years are the blink of an eye. Through all the despotisms and imperfect lives, the image of freedom has endured, and visionaries have kept pressing for it. Confucius' teachings center on the right relationship of self and society. The Hebrew prophets argue for social justice and compassion, as did Muhammad 1,000 years later. Jesus emphasized the spirit over the letter of the law. Augustine saw freedom in an all-consuming love of God. But as Jesus reminds us, God is invisible and can only be loved through loving those around us. So perhaps when we're finished, it comes down to this. The ultimate statement of freedom is this. Love your neighbor and do whatever you will. We leave this sacred time together. Our world needs us and the spirit we carry forth. Amen.